I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Here is where the penetration and predictive power of big data seem to be taking us. A tiny example. The online matchmaker called OkCupid finds that 3/4 of the long-term couples who have met through their algorithms gave the same answer, yes or no, to these two questions. Do you like scary movies? And have you traveled alone in a foreign country? Couples that huddle together in horror flicks are going to cuddle together for a lifetime, it seems. Think about it. From their sorted billions of data points, conscious and unconscious preferences, photo reactions, follow-up results, dating services like Tinder, Match.com, Date Hookup, know vastly more by now than Freud ever did about the secret needs and desires, the hopes and illusions that drive human beings. So, our mission this hour is to mine that mountain of evidence for something a little grander than first date, sex cues, and targeted advertising. Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web, says we're wasting the opportunity to get rich data out of big data. That is, to find a rounded new humanism through this digitized data set. We begin this hour with OkCupid's chief of analytics, Christian Rudder, who has connected some of the dizzying details of what dating sites learn in a book called Dataclysm, Who We Are When We Think No One Is Looking. And then Astra Taylor, filmmaker and web polymath, distinctly of the humanistic persuasion, who says that this corporate and commercial model of the social web is all wrong. And then at the intersection of scientific data and old-time religious faith, Shelley Brown, who's a postdoctoral researcher in stem cell biology at MIT and a working preaching minister at Western Avenue Baptist Church in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Christian Rudder, you're up first, but listen first to what the people say. In the Boston Public Garden this week, we asked them, what do you think Google doesn't know about you?
At this point, I'd be surprised if there was anything Google didn't know about me.
They don't know that I'm afraid of bees. They probably would not get an idea of my personality from Facebook, because what I put on Facebook is mostly self-promotional.
You share everything. I mean, they track every search you make, every purchase you buy. I'm not sure what they don't know.
Google knows everything. Like, I don't know.
They don't know, like, your medical records. I don't
think
so.
Yeah, they wouldn't.
They don't know that I'm here right now at this very moment. Maybe, unless the maps guys are looking down at us. They don't know everything.
The less they know, the better. I try to minimize my exposure at all costs.
I guess I read more than I put on Facebook, and no one really cares what books I'm reading. But besides that, you know, my family information's all linked, you know, my school stuff, where I work, I got pictures of all my friends on there, so I'm probably pretty tapped into my life.
Christian Rudder, you're tapped into all of our lives. Shock us, make us laugh, make us cry with some of the stuff that you glean about all of us, starting maybe with the ways that age and skin color and ethnic types, the many shades of beauty and attractiveness, do and don't deflect our interest in each other online. Can I say first, we all laughed at your charts about how women and men consider the other's age. Women through life are looking for a man within 3 or 4 years of their own age. Men into their 70s are ever and always looking for a woman about 22 years old. Improve on that. Tell us more.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, running a dating site, you get a kind of direct channel into someone's, like, sexual id, I guess. And that data is from people voting on each other, and definitely in terms of just that kind of raw attraction that I think those ones indicate. Men might get older, but they don't really grow up. men throughout our entire database, basically they as young as the women can get, that is what they prefer, at least by these votes. But then when they have to go decide on who to message, which requires them to put themselves out there, put a little bit of themselves on the line, risk rejection, you can see them in the data, you know, make a compromise between what ostensibly they want and then who they're actually willing to message. The men typically message women closer to their own age, although still quite a bit younger.
So many other aspects beyond beauty, but we'll come back to it.
Sure.
Money. People, you say, are 20% poorer than they say they are.
Oh yeah, that was a post we put on our blog. I don't actually treat the money stuff in the book because people do that kind of lying for sure, or misrepresentation. I think if you go through OkCupid's database, we have many more millionaires than supposedly exist in the United States, according to the IRS. So either people are really lying, or there's just a whole plague of 18 and 19 year old millionaires out there on online dating sites. Definitely people exaggerate. You know, they exaggerate their income, they exaggerate their height. But that kind of stuff isn't that much different than what people do in real life. I mean, people will sit on a bar stool and sit there and, you know, hey, I used to be an Army Ranger or whatever, you know, like pose as people always have posed to one another. And they just do it by typing, essentially, rather than sitting there in person with their beer in their hand and telling you some story about a scar, about how they were wounded in Iraq or whatever, when really they, you know, got to mow the lawn or who knows what. You know what I mean? Like, it's not actually that different.
Sample some of those half furtive questions that people ask on the web. Like, you know, in your book, I read people asking, why do white people have thin lips?
We're
listening to humanity's inner monologue. Maybe that's your line. A la James Joyce. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, that's from Google's autocomplete. You know, if you type why do and then choose any type of group, gay people, white people, black people, whatever, it will suggest stereotypes that other people have put into Google's kind of hive mind back at you. I know the surprising ones for me were where you type why do gay people and then why do gay couples come back to you, it says look alike. And that was not a stereotype that I was aware of, although of course now I am. So it's kind of like both tells of and then also causes people's stereotypes, you know, which is an interesting role for that interface to play.
But how is it people give themselves away in those questions?
Oh, I mean, in Google search, as your listeners just revealed, I mean, people type everything into that open box. I mean, symptoms for disease, concerns about, I don't know, being pregnant or not, questions about life, does God exist, looking for porn, looking for the nearest burger joint. I mean, people run so much of their lives or their, like, just their psyche through that box, you know. And so Google, as part of the process of delivering on that search promise, you know, they collect that stuff and they know a person inside and out in some ways, you know, especially because people do Google things that are physically wrong with them even. But, you know, I think one point, though, that just to expand on the kind of intro segment, you know, Google is highly interested in aggregated data. They want to market to people who are looking for burger joints. You know, they want to be able to recommend stuff like that, or find people looking for diapers so that they can advertise, you know, children's clothes or whatever to them. But they don't ever look at what, no human being at Google ever looks at a single person's search records without some kind of subpoena or something. So it's, you know, they do know a tremendous amount in the aggregate. And of course the aggregate is made up of individuals, but an individual life is never exposed to that lens.
Christian Roeder, I keep wondering in your book, is the internet changing us or is it discovering and revealing us? In other words, I mean, how much of this is new? How many of your findings on beauty, on sex, on money are specific to this culture? How many would show up in Homer's Greece, for example, or in China today?
I mean, I think I definitely was not alive in Homer's Greece, but I can only imagine that men also found younger women attractive then too. And I've talked about this with other data scientists. The more you spend with this data, the more your kind of cynical intuition about human nature is confirmed. And if you find yourself surprised, often you're probably screwing up, because insofar as people are living their lives through these things, I mean, human life is something we've had millennia to think about and posit on. And so we do understand some fundamental things, but you get to see it with just a very specific, like, numerical clarity, which can be very amusing. I think stuff like Twitter, I mean, it does change how people act. The cloak of anonymity can make people more angry, can certainly let people act out their anger more than they would ever in person. I mean, it's like Twitter enables this kind of digital road rage, I think. I think the answer is it both changes and reflects society.
What else does it enable? I kept wondering about the hookup culture. Did the web enable the transsexual era we seem to be in, or the softening line between gay and straight, which is seems to me a matter of this moment?
I mean, it probably does, because it adds fluidity. That's kind of an awful pun, but to dating market, so that if you have people that perhaps in a normal situation, you know, out there in the world, the vibe is straight, you know. But if you're not, you can find other people who fit your description of what you're looking for much more easily online. You know, and as far as hookup culture, you know, that's a built-in. I mean, you could ask the same thing about whether Katy Perry kind of encourages it. Also, you know, it's this whole matrix of cultural forces that seem to be pushing people that way. If you ask me,
you reminded me of the great Dostoevsky, who observed and discovered in a Siberian prison himself on a long term, that he said, "Man is a creature who can get used to anything," and I believe he wrote that is the very best way of describing him. We're adapting to instant global communications on the web, but are they changing us? At the core of us, what's new here about us, if anything?
I think it's hard to argue that attention spans aren't going down. I felt it in myself. I think, I don't know where the data is for this, but you know, my phone beeps and it vibrates and the light is shining and the old school part of me, it drives me crazy, but then of course I check it. I think it makes, well, here's some data. I mean, on OkCupid, our average length of first message has dropped drastically in the last, say, 9 years. And a huge driver of that, of course, is a mobile phone and both the sort of disposability of those conversations and the fact that the keyboard is tiny. I mean, you know, you have thick fingers and you're mistyping and it just takes forever. So you cut to the chase or, you know, omit needless words as Strunk would dictate. But, you know, I think it does change things.
We'll come back to that. You have lots of good news as you see it happening on the web, but you also note it is changing our language. It's shortening our sentences. It's eliminating, among other things, our sense of history. Time in the New World began in the year 2000 or thereabouts. And I wonder, is it a good idea that, as you write, we're getting more wrapped up in the present? We're talking about the web as we might redesign it. I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. On the chance that we could start the digital age all over again now that we know it's going to transform almost everything. Why not for the better? For Astra Taylor, web culture is dream come true some days, nightmare on others. You'll see the Renaissance range of her interests in her movies with critical explorers like Cornel West and Martha Nussbaum, and her feature film on the philosopher Zizek, all of it on YouTube. Her book is called The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. Swing away, Astra Taylor, at Christian Rutter's, should we say, technobabble and discoveries. He's still with us and he's ready to swing back at you. What's wrong with his picture?
Oh, I mean, I think Christian's picture of the present is partly accurate, and definitely interesting and entertaining. I read his book and was definitely amused. You know, one thing that struck me, as you just said, was that a lot of it isn't surprising. You know, to kind of learn, okay, when people are at the keyboard on a dating site, you know, men look for younger women or are less inclined to message women of different races or something like that. It kind of affirms what we think we know about people. I think where I beg to differ is in the assertion that this tells us something about human nature and something timeless. You know, and so you all invoked, you know, going back to, you know, ancient times and men probably liked younger women. But things haven't stayed the same in the millennia that have transpired since then. You know, there have been radical transformations in the last century in terms of the freedom of sexual expression, especially for women. And so, you know, that to me is the more interesting element. It's how we've changed and how we are actually always split subjects. You know, there's always part of us that wants something in the moment, but we also want something else. There's something, you know, we're attracted to and we desire with one part of our psyche, but, you know, another aspect of us craves something different. You know, maybe it's a higher or a lower self, or maybe putting a value judgment on it isn't entirely appropriate. But the fact is that we're divided and we're split and we want different things.
Can I note, Astra Taylor and Christian Rutter, to me the problem with all that data is that it's what we used to call reductionist. It's so much of it hangs on sex and on marketing. And I want to expand the terms of all of these conversations on the web. I wish they were more like your films, Astra Taylor, if I may say. But you think there's a fundamental corporate and commercial flaw in the whole business. Expand on that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, right now we're focusing, well, what does this tell us about the little people who contribute their crumbs, and that's big data. But, you know, what does it tell us about the powerful? You know, the minority who actually are the people who control the data and have proprietary access to it. And, you know, what do the platforms that they build reflect? What values are reflected in those platforms, and what interests do they serve? And largely, these are commercial interests. You know, and so in that sense, it's not that novel. The web isn't that radical. It's kind of a retrograde future that we found ourselves in, where, you know, even though we have this amazing new technical infrastructure, this new communications infrastructure, it's still beholden to the same old advertisers and marketers that, you know, ran the TV stations. You know,
that would be network. My suspicion, too, that we're in some fashion still being manipulated, we're being distracted, we're being focused, we're being gamed. What's to do about it?
And we're given, you know, and the model is, we'll, you know, still give people what they like, give people more of what it is that they, you know, they want. And I would love to see an internet that had a kind of more complicated conception of desire and understood that you also need to frustrate them, and you not just accommodate them and cater to them, but also challenge them and frustrate them, because that's what growth is. It's not just giving you more and more of what you like over and over.
That's what draws on Cornel West's insistence on courage in confronting what we don't want, what's not familiar.
Yeah, and that's a very hard business model, because if you give people too much of what they don't want, they're not going to use your site. So obviously there's a conflict there, and it has to be done in a way that, you know, is enlarging and doesn't just, you know, make you want to give up. But I you know, the model of the kind of the tyranny of the likes and the kind of idea that a lot of predictive algorithms or, you know, these recommendations engines are based on giving you more of what it is you've liked in the past, creates a sort of feedback loop that other people have sounded alarms about.
Astra Taylor, let me just say, Tim Berners-Lee, who invented the web, agrees with you entirely on a big point that we should retain ownership of all of our data. We should control this game and, by implication, change the subject. How would you do it?
Well, there are different ways. I mean, you know, one reason that a site like OkCupid is able to get access to all this data is because, you know, users get to use the site for free, and this is the same model Facebook and Google have. You know, ultimately, it's advertisers paying the bills, and so in a sense, users are kind of free riders. So that means we're not, you know, we don't have as much of a say over what happens to our data. So then, if they use it to, you know, analyze it and segment us and market things to us, or maybe discriminate against us, well, you know, too bad, because we weren't the paying customers anyway. So, you know, one possibility could be maybe start doing local community scale networks, community scale control of data, or people controlling more of their own. And there are different experiments in going in this direction. Other models would be, you know, getting away from the commercial model, carving out a few more spaces on the web that are non-commercial. I mean, everybody who writes about the internet loves Wikipedia. It's kind of the model is often heralded as kind of the exemplar of what the net could be. But the thing is, there's only one Wikipedia. It's the only nonprofit site, you know, in the top 100 sites that are visited. So what's salient about Wikipedia is also how unusual it is as a nonprofit entity. So how could we create more sites like that aren't beholden to the same commercial pressures? Or could there be an extension of public media in a digital age? Why does that have to go away just because we're not in the old broadcast model where there is spectrum scarcity, but now we have, you know, unlimited bandwidth on the web? But that shouldn't make the idea of publicly financing media obsolete.
Christian Rutter, I wonder if you want to, do you want to defend the commercial model? OkCupid does entice people. It strips them to some degree of their private information. It tricks them sometimes for research purposes, and then it retains the right to sell everything they learn from people providing this stuff so innocently.
Sure. I mean, I only laughed because I'm just, you know, I'm not, there's a lot that Astra stands for and has to say that I totally agree with. So, you know, I'm not definitely not here to like try to tear down her arguments or defend my own for that matter, you know, but also like, I mean, I think it would be great if there were websites that were created for free that people could use, but it's just, they aren't, people could do that. That's a possibility right now. You know, there's nothing stopping that from happening. It just doesn't happen because people don't want to work for free and servers cost money and all of this stuff. Like, I mean, that's just an unfortunate reality.
But people do want to work for free. I wish you'd both speak up. You've both been members of bands.
But, you know, like Wikipedia, for example, has the same problem that, I mean, if we're talking about, you know, selection bias or any of these other things, like almost all the contributors to Wikipedia are men. It's like, and they're almost all Western. It's like a known problem there too. It's just, you know, like the freeness doesn't solve a lot of the problems necessarily. Now it does solve the advertiser's imperative hanging over things. And I don't like that any more than any of you guys do, I assume, you know, like, and OkCupid, just for the record, makes almost all of its money from paying subscribers. You know, we have a small set of maybe 8% of the people pay for premium features.
I send Wikipedia a check every time they ask, just to be loyal. But let me ask you both, as artists in different ways, you've both been band members, speak up for the creative opportunities that the web has created for you. Just, this is a little bit of the good news that I think you both want to share.
Yeah, I mean, I'm happy to take this. I mean, my band is definitely by far less popular than Astra's, and so maybe it's more relevant, you know, like the internet is amazing for getting your music out there. You can't get on the radio. Before that was kind of the end of the story, or at least it would be passed around on mixtapes and stuff like this. And, you know, being able to email promoters or even just blogs or whoever, MP3s, it was great. The culture of freeness that pervades music on the internet, I don't like, you know, I think generally people, forget that it's not the album that, you know, it's not the thing that you're getting that you're really paying for when you buy something. It's not that particular instance of it. It's the next one, you know, like that album is already made. If you don't pay for it, well, it's still made. But the next one might not be if you don't pay for that one. It's the same with movies, the same with any of these things.
Astra, I love your own story about as a 12-year-old or whatever, doing a mimeographed newsletter of the neighborhood or your visions of the world. And then the discovery with the web that, holy mackerel, you could reach the universe. I mean,
yeah, that's amazing. And I tried to strike a balance. You know, I agree with what Christian just said. I mean, it's just in terms of the distribution opportunities, it's amazing. You know, but there are two problems. One is the problem of production, which is how do you fund making the next thing, just as he said. So I talk in the book about this moment when, you know, it was funny that you said her films are available on YouTube. Well, they're available on YouTube because fans have uploaded them and cut them into little segments that I didn't authorize. and yet I don't ask them to take them down because I'm happy for people to see them. And right now I'm kind of able to sustain myself. But right before a major theatrical release of my last film, I actually wrote somebody who had uploaded my movie, and I said, it's coming out at the theaters in 2 weeks. Would you take it down and put it up in a couple months? And they told me, no, I won't do that because philosophy is free. And they meant free as in speech, as in the world needs to have ideas. And I felt really conflicted because I was like, yes, it does. But also it cost me a fortune and 2 years of my life to make this. And so there's a paradox there. And the point is that there actually is money circulating. And that money is overwhelmingly going through, I think, what is a very inefficient funding model, which is advertising. And it's not transparent. It's not accountable. We essentially spend as a globe something like $700 billion a year on this mechanism that sort of trickles some money out to sustain some of our cultural productions and our social media platforms and stuff. But it means that they get to shape it, and they get to kind of determine what priorities are prioritized, what, you know, why the platforms look the way we do, why they look the way they do and not some other way. And, you know, also get to shape what content is generated. And, you know, there are scandals monthly about the way that advertisers call the shots at publications, you know, about what can or can't be reported on. So I think these are the, you know, the problem is the issue of production. How do things get made? But then also that these platforms are not neutral because advertisers are paying the bills. And we see the way that these these platforms that we've been told to kind of put our faith into, because they're how we're going to reach an audience as artists, we're seeing the way that they're closing in and you know, not the sort of open channels that we long believed they were.
Let me just say, the motives, the money, are so mysterious in this game, including this matter of how much we value our private identities, if we value them at all. Our producer, Connor Gillies, spoke with the artist Risa Puno, who had set up a street stand in Brooklyn trading homemade cookies for people's personal data.
My booth was called Please Enable Cookies, and I offered homemade cookies in flavors like pink peppercorn pistachio, brown butter rosemary snickerdoodle, peanut butter coconut curry, in exchange for personal identifying information. So this was kind of a play on the way digital cookies are what websites use to collect our information. And in my installation, we took actual information using actual cookies. And so participants could choose what information they wanted to give in order to get the cookie that they wanted. So the information was a photo of your face, your email address, telephone number, home address, driver's license number, date of birth, place of birth, mother's maiden name, the last four of your social security number, and then questions: what is your favorite food? What is the name of your first teacher? What is the name of your childhood best friend? What is the first album you owned? What is the first car you owned? What is the name of your first pet? And then a place for your 10 fingerprints. 380 people participated over 2 days. They'd ask, what are you doing with this? And I'd say, funny you ask, it's all in our terms of use. I would flip over the form and it had a long terms of service in 6-point font. What it said to me, first of all, is that we're willing to give a lot of information for cookies that are, you know, simply amusing, fun, delicious, but with no real nutritional value. So, you know, maybe that means we don't value our personal information, or maybe it just means that we place a very high value on entertainment.
Christian Rutter, Astrid Taylor, so what's the payoff here? Is there any justice in these deals? Christian?
Well, I mean, justice, I mean, I don't know, you know? I mean, like, the fact that websites collect information is, I feel like, widely known, you know? And people do, to a certain extent, go into that with their eyes open. Or let me put it this way. People's eyes are increasingly open to that fact. And
well, maybe they just enjoy having their eyes shut.
That's also possible. Human nature is a tricky thing, for sure. So, but in these sites are increasingly popular. And I'm not, you know, I think there's a lot of very valid critiques of the internet, for sure, you know. And I guess the point of my book is to show, well, like, given that this is happening, that people are trading information for services or cookies or whatever you want to call it, what is something interesting that you can make out of it, or something of cultural or human value? And so that's where I'm going for, or what I'm trying to do in my book.
Astrid Taylor, let me say, Christian says men get older, but they don't grow up. The web's getting older, but I keep waiting for it to grow up, to get into a more serious and a larger human frame. Can you help us get there?
Well, it's growing up in the sense of, you know, it's growing up and kind of selling out or whatever. And I think we need to keep some of the radical rabble-rousing spirit, you know, that was there at its inception. I mean, I think the big data conversation really needs to be expanded beyond just the issue of, like, you know, okay, they're collecting my personal data, but I don't have anything to hide, or, well, I don't mind the advertisements that I see on the side of the screen. And to look at the way that big data is becoming part of employment, healthcare, who gets insured, who gets car insurance, who gets housing.
Spell that out. Who's denied any of those things because of the web, and why?
Right. And the way that these data brokers and dossiers, and the way that government databases and corporate databases are used kind of interchangeably, they're, you know, dossiers are masked with stuff from both. And it can lead to new types of discrimination. And so it can not only reflect existing social inequities, but actually amplify them. So I was, you know, reading in The Economist the other day, and there's something about a data broker who is looking to was looking at 3 million data points from 3,000 companies to try to find out who's employable. And they found out that people who use, you know, who go the extra mile of installing a web browser on their computer are better employees. And they also found that employees who have a short commute are better employees. Well, you know, first off, that implies people who have computers, and also people who probably live in pretty nice neighborhoods. So there are all these ways, these insidious kind of invisible ways that discrimination you know, has new ways of manifesting. And so I think those are the things that we need to be alert to. And you know, I don't blame people for clicking yes on the terms of service, because who has time to read 10,000 words about stuff like this? We shouldn't have to do that. There should be regulations that create a privacy baseline. We shouldn't all have to be like looking at every single site and application and device. And, you know, we all have jobs. We have lives.
I think we're still on day two of the internet, really. It's still to be formed. This is just the early crackle, the big bang. I just wonder, Esther Taylor, what's your model of where we might go on day 9, day 700?
Well, I like what, you know, Kristen said about there could be interesting good things to do with this information. And I completely agree with that. I think that the big data could go in all sorts of interesting directions and model all sorts of, you know, socially important things.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, repurposing the web and big data as a humanistic project to stretch the grander dimensions of who we people are, past the matchups and the merchandise. Our guest, Shelley Brown, is a postdoc stem cell researcher at MIT. Right down Massachusetts Avenue in Cambridge, she is a preaching minister at the Western Avenue Baptist Church. I jumped at the chance to engage you, Reverend Brown, because I've been puzzling for years what to do with the thought that the web has so many attributes that we were brought up to assign to God. It's everywhere. It's nowhere. It sees everything. It remembers everything. It takes note of us one by one, waking and sleeping. Google, as the song says, has the whole world in its hands. What do we make of this? Welcome, Shirley Brown. Shirley.
Oh, hello. Welcome. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I think that it's an extremely interesting topic, and I appreciate the different vantage points and how both Christian as well as Astra weighed in on this particular subject as it relates to big data and collection of very personal information. As you said, Chris, earlier, it's a fascinating notion of the multitude of attributes that individuals can ascribe to God in terms of God being everywhere and very real, yet invisible and intangible to the touch, leading us and guiding us in many different ways in terms of every time that you leave the house and you decide to get in the car and go somewhere you don't know, you contact Google and ask for directions. And in many ways, when you're traveling through the roads of life and you don't understand where to go and what to do, those that ascribe to a faith in a higher being definitely seek God to understand the directions and guidance that they need. So I think it's a very interesting topic in that, just like God, Google never sleeps or slumbers. So.
Right. But is it a metaphor, or maybe more, on the Guardian website today, no connection with our program, I'm reading a Swedish theologian who says the web is God, connecting 7 billion human beings in real time. He says, if that isn't the Holy Spirit, then I don't know what is.
And I find that to be a very fascinating metaphor and interesting parallel that he is drawing there, where this concept of oneness and unity and interconnectedness that would be a web and would be in many ways, I guess perhaps what this individual is alluding to is that this is the workings of the Holy Spirit. This is the true work of the unity and the togetherness in the body through the Holy Spirit. And I find that to be a very interesting take on it. Whether right, wrong, or in between, I think it's a very interesting take. And my particular vantage point and entry point into this conversation as it relates to the intersection of science and religion is just basically understanding that this is a situation where you have science, you have data, and you have God, and you have these two society ordering institutions that produce authoritative knowledge. So then how do we as a society understand how to integrate this into our culture and take all of this information that we find from sites such as OkCupid and other dating websites where we're able to find out better who we should be with and our likes and our dislikes. And
you made a connection, Shelley Brown, in the human tissue lab, and I wish you'd share it as concisely as you can.
Oh, yes, sure. So one of the things that really intrigued me as a scientist working in a laboratory was when I first started my PhD program using human embryonic stem cells. And there was a moment in which I was in the laboratory. I was trying to differentiate my cells into bone tissue, and I found that the cells had become beating cardiomyocytes, beating heart cells. And in that moment, that's where I felt as though I met the divine and I was at the mercy of nature and at the mercy of God. So for me, that I have definitely gotten a chance to understand that there are overlapping domains that exist between science and religion, and perhaps in this instance, exist between God and Google.
Astra Taylor, I have a feeling that Cornel West would know what she's talking about, and Zizek too, probably.
Well, you know, it brings in a little Zizek for me, or rather Lacan, who is the psychoanalyst that Zizek follows. So, you know, for Lacan, there's always the big other, you know, the big symbolic order, the sense that there's always something watching us, that we're actually, you know, we are never totally alone. We always have this sense of a gaze. And I find it kind of interesting that humans have manifested this. I mean, I'm not a religious person, so, you know, for me, it's something that's been manifested in religion. But I find it, you know, fascinating that we went from a myth of the eye in the sky, God, to kind of the all-seeing iPhone, and we're kind of making our mythologies manifest through technology. And what we're seeing is just as God can be a loving and benign force, it can also be a judgmental one, and in a way, these you know, communications networks are the same thing.
I keep wondering, is the internet, the web, as God, is he a punishing God? Is he a forgiving God? Is he an accepting God? What do you think, Shelley?
Well, I definitely think that attributing all of those different characteristics to the internet, you can definitely get into murky and tricky waters. I think with the internet, it's very different in that with God, you have this sense of privacy and intimacy and relationship, versus with the internet, there is really no feedback. There's just hard data. So if in many ways, I would say that could be a very stone-faced and unforgiving God if we had to assign characteristics to the internet as God. But it's a very interesting interplay.
Christian Rutter, what can you tease out of that?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess because I've worked in this industry for so long, I've become very resistant to the hyperbole, you know, whether it's from a Scottish priest or it's some, you know, VC out in Silicon Valley talking up the internet and how it's God and all this stuff. Like, you know, it's also just, it's like a technology that people invented and that people work on and that people use. But it is, you know, and it has a lot of awesome things about it for sure. And I love that it connects people. I love that OkCupid has brought together, you know, probably over a million marriages, you know, in our time.
Right.
Close to it. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a popular site, you know, and those are couples and those children, those genetic combinations would never have been created without this website. That's not to say those people wouldn't have found happiness somewhere else. But at the same time, you know, if you asked them, would you, you know, give up your wife or your husband for this other abstract thing you would have found otherwise, they would all probably say no. Go ahead.
Think of those messages that people send and share on OkCupid, these confessional searches, these probes, these kind of admitting dark things about themselves, explaining what they're looking for. To me, this is an incredible echo in that Psalm 139, which I love for so many reasons. But it says, you know, David, or whoever wrote the psalm, is saying, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts." It sounds like an OkCupid appeal, a prayer to OkCupid.
Yeah, it does in some ways. Yeah, for sure. I mean, don't mistake me. I'm not claiming to play God with any of the stuff. But, you know, like, it is to just run with the metaphor for a second, I think, you know, if people do reveal themselves to the internet in a way that maybe they've only revealed themselves to their God before, or they pray to it or whatever it is, like with data and with the ability to analyze it, again, in the aggregate and with the, you know, humanistic principles applied, you get to look into the mind of God, not just the minds of people, and see what the all-seeing being sees, again, to run with the metaphor. And that's what I find so interesting about it. You know, I think Astra's right that there is a judgmental power to the internet, of course, and there's a controlling power to it, definitely, and all these kind of Old Testament attributes, you know. And I don't, you know, even the people who work on these sites aren't that excited about these things. It's just, it's kind of built into it right now. And I wish it were better. And a lot of people on you know, my side, if there's a side, agree that it would be great if things were more open and people were less judgmental online and anger was less enabled.
Hmm.
Well, I would like, I mean,
Esther Taylor, please.
The God that is ultimately being served is the God our broader society worships, which is the God of money. And, you know, the internet hasn't been able to transcend that. And that, you know, ultimately that is, I think, the message that on the one hand is so simple, but cannot be stated enough, which is that the economic system determines a lot of what's possible. And that's why people who would rather work on a different sort of service end up, you know, being employed by a company they feel ambivalent about. Or why people who want to be journalists end up creating clickbait, because that's the economic model. And, you know, just as religion was corrupted by money in many instances, you know, technology can be too.
And yet it grows, it persists, still asks big questions, gives a lot of people big answers. Shirley Brown, first, how would you build on that notion in a non-commercial, searching, quasi-religious, but universal sort of quest?
I would build on that in terms of understanding that it is a very different enterprise. It's a very different journey, and I think seeking that people take when you are seeking God versus seeking something on the internet. I think that although there are definitely economic and commercial aspects of religion, going back to what I mentioned earlier in terms of the difference between God and Google is that privacy, the intimacy, and the relationship that you have with God. I think that you're able to really avoid some of the economic and commercial issues that automatically would arise and be inherent in the commercial aspects of the internet. So to build upon that, I think that is one major issue that I would consider. And then secondly, going back to something also that Chris said earlier in terms of the disposability of conversations, where there are shorter conversations and messages that were apparent over the past 9 years, and something that came to mind was whether or not that was not only changing our language and how we interact with each other, but within faith communities, how does that change how we interact with the divine if we are in a technological age where it's very fast and quick results and gratification that we seek? Are we seeking that both in Google as well as in God? So I think that those are two things that really come to mind as we're discussing all of this.
Short sentences to God, you mean? It reminds me of Annie Lamott, who said all prayer basically comes down to please, 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 or thank you, thank you, thank you. That'll do. Astra Taylor, how would you build an aggressively anti-commercial new conversation around, should we say, the search for wisdom, the search for understanding, not gossip, not individuals yelping, a bigger picture?
Right. Well, I think, you know, I enjoy my short messages and my tweets, you know, as much as the next person. I just would like them to be supplemented with something else. And I want to create and expand a space for that something else. I think this is, you know, technologies encourage or discourage certain, you know, aspects of, you know, what Christian's been calling human nature. You know, and I think the book is a wonderful technology because it is a kind of anti-distraction technology, because it doesn't light up and it doesn't beep and it doesn't drag you to something else. Could we see spaces that are more designed for deep dives into text or into images and sound? And can we support people to make those things? Because this comes back to the labor question, and like, what, you know, how are things funded and how are things paid for? You know, and can we create a society where people have time then to actually engage with these texts or these images or these sounds? Because, you know, we're all so overworked and so busy all the time. I mean, one reason we like these short tidbits is because we're looking at our phones in kind of stolen moments, the job or when we're in transit. So, you know,
Astra Taylor, lead the way.
It's also our lives.
Lead the way in a new conversation, and we will follow you to the end. I want to ask Christian Rutter before we're done. You speak of this, and we can all feel it, all of this data as an unbelievable anthropological, sociological, psychological mind. I wonder, does serious social science catch on? Is it changing social science?
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. Yeah, I mean, even OkCupid is a fraction the size of Facebook or Google, and we get a request from an academic at least once a week, and they must get maybe 1,000 a week for access to their data. And you know, social scientists are very eager to look at these, you know, large aggregated data sets of people living out some portion of their lives, you know, because that's how, you know, science is reductionist. I think that's a valid charge against the data too, but, you know, F equals MA is reductionist, and but it's useful. And scientists want to look at this data to come up with other useful theories about how people act.
What would you most like to tease out of that treasure trove of yourself?
I mean, the thing I'm most excited about, which is not yet available, is some idea of, you know, how getting older works, what it's like. You know, that this data isn't very old. There's only 5-6 years of good data on this. But just looking at how a person's cultural tastes change, how their outlook on their children changes as they get older, on their peers, as they're, you know, the whole idea of being able to look at the aggregated data of people aging. I just turned 39, so this is how my...
You're well begun. Did I take you correctly to mean that this is... your data, your questions and answers reinforce a fundamental cynicism, and I wonder what's the way to expand a notion of ourselves.
I meant that somewhat facetiously, but yeah, I mean, you know, you look at enough people trying to imagine being the barkeep in a bar of 20 million people and watching them all trying to hook up every day. You would probably get pretty cynical after a while too, you
pretty
know.
Drunk.
Well, for take away the alcohol, it kind of makes it worse in some ways. So, but I think there is still a lot to learn. I mean, especially working with academics, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that big data on the internet side is going to replace sociology or philosophy or any of these things. I see it as a supplement and hopefully as a partner going forward.
Last word, Charlie Brown.
I just want to say that this is really a fascinating topic. And one thing that I saw in the MIT Technology Review is that they conducted a study just back in June in terms of trying to understand the increase of internet usage and the decline of religious affiliation. And I think that this has implications on the future of faith. Does religious affiliation become another opportunity cost of our digital world? And how do we truly balance the two?
Interesting. Astrid Taylor, do you have a last word on where we're going?
Where are we going? Well, we're going wherever humans want to go, and I think that, you know, that the aspect of human agency is really important, and having a sort of conversation about what it is that we want and what aspects of our nature we want to have encouraged and to see reflected and built upon, and that's why some of the big data conversations, you know, are a little worrisome. It's like, well, this is how we are, and I think, you know, one way human beings are is, you know, we're mutable. We're species that recognize, you know, ourselves and recognize that we can change and evolve.
For me, I want to see more of your examined life, Astrid Taylor, on the web. Thank you, Shirley Brown, Christian Rutter, Astrid Taylor. Christian Rutter's book is called Dataclysm. Astrid Taylor's is The People's Platform. Thanks also to the cookie artist, Risa Puno. You can hear Connor Gillies' piece on Risa Puno's cookie project on our website, radioopensource.org. And Connor's longer story on the environmental composer of symphonic music, John Luther Adams. There's also my own conversation with the journalist Lawrence Wright on his terrific drama built around Jimmy Carter's Camp David Accords. Our show this week was produced by Max Larkin and Connor Gillies with help from Maria Jose Fabre. George Hicks has engineered the program. Mary McGrath is in charge of our data. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.